Thundergrunt.
Bob.
Merry Christmas.
That's right.
Introduce yourselves and say, if you're sick, tell us why.
I am Jimmy George, even though I sound like a completely different person because I have a cold.
And who are you?
I am a full-time screenwriter. I mean, full-time script consultant and wannabe full-time screenwriter.
That's the Ambien. Yeah. The NyQuil drunk.
Yeah.
Jamie?
I am Jamie Nash. I have a good white blood cell count at the moment. I'm a screenwriter.
And I'm Bob Rose, and I sometimes do film stuff. And my blood work was pretty good the last time I got it checked.
Dude,
so
that's so good to hear.
We're all talking about health. This is a health episode.
You guys need
got
to
your
be
lipids checked.
Yeah, everything was good. Cholesterol was great.
Nice.
Dude, all that's so good. Glad. Nothing like finding that out in the holidays.
I haven't felt this good since 1990 when I think Home Alone came out.
Home Alone.
We're going to talk about Home Alone.
Segway.
Jamie, how popular was Home Alone?
Home Alone was so popular that $285 million jumped into its pocket in 1990. That's domestic.
Whoa.
That is domestic. It beat out movies. This is a pretty good year. It beat out movies like another one we probably should do on the podcast one day, Ghost, which made 217.
I love to do
that film.
Million.
Yeah. Love that script.
Dances with Wolves, which at the time was kind of a juggernaut.
Yeah.
And I saw it in the theater. It was like 3 hours long. Had a big bowl of popcorn. Pretty Woman, which was another juggernaut time. You know, everybody wanted to see that movie. And one of Bob's favorites, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles at $135 million.
Look.
What a year for...
I would also be down to do an episode on that because I think that script is great.
I agree. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a great script.
Dude, let's do it.
I'm just saying. We got plenty of options.
Dude.
1990.
I can't wait.
It's funny. As huge as those top fives are, it gets a little weird after that. I'm just going to go into this super quick. The Hunt for Red October.
Okay.
You know? I mean, okay, but not one I even think would be in a top 10 list.
That's a John McTiernan classic.
Total Recall. Which is pretty good, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. Die Hard 2, Die Harder.
Okay. Christmas movie, too.
Christmas, yeah.
Yeah.
A sort of underrated movie in some sense, in my opinion, Dick Tracy.
I love Dick Tracy. You know?
That was the first movie I ever saw in a theater, by the way. So that's some Bob history for you. At the Senator in Baltimore. Yeah.
Kindergarten Cop in 10.
Yes.
And then Back to the Future 3 at number 11.
Holy shit.
Yeah, pretty incredible. You know,
it's
just
so weird
11,
to think of the third one as a 90s movie.
Right.
I associate that trilogy with
the
80s.
That's a good point.
Also, pretty sure I own the VHS of every one of those movies sitting somewhere in a closet at my mom's house.
It was a year of sequels. Godfather 3, Three Men and a Little Lady,
another
48 Hours. You know, it was like sequels. Crazy.
Jesus.
Anyway.
Well, I mean, we're talking about the beginning of a franchise, whether we want to talk about that. We don't have to.
Are there five?
There's...
Really?
I think there's actually...
I thought there was three.
No. There's actually... I think there might be six, but I haven't checked.
Buddies, Home Alone or something?
Yeah.
There's Home Alone 3 was in theaters. 4 was on straight to DVD, and then 5 was like a Lifetime movie. And I think maybe something went past that, but
I've seen the box sets.
I really didn't know.
And I was like, how are there so many titles in this box set?
What? Yeah. The third one was the one they changed.
The kid. And it was him versus terrorists.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that was the last one I even knew existed. I don't think I've seen it, but maybe I have. Maybe I've
it's
seen it.
It's not the same. Sort of it's not on Christmas terrorists. Either. It's just during the winter.
I remember a remote control car or something.
That's way too. The batteries are way too good.
Right.
Yeah, like it jumps over an entire street.
That's like all I remember.
I saw it in the theaters and I was not happy. But.
So this one
theatrical.
Yeah, no, I saw that Home Alone 3 in theaters.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
We did a Thanksgiving podcast with the John Hughes classic, and now we're doing a Christmas podcast, sort of with the John Hughes classic.
Yeah,
At least
also starring John Candy.
Also starring John Candy in a sort of strangely similar role in some ways.
Yeah.
I guess so. Yeah.
Just a wink to it. I mean, not really.
I wouldn't say it's a cameo by John Candy, kind of. I wouldn't say starring in it.
Yeah. I almost feel like his stuff is ad-libbed, all his stuff.
It's the role where it's like the caricature of John Candy's magic coming in and being like, of course, it's like this movie, if this movie needed anything, here it is right here.
Yeah.
The delightful cameo.
I wish he played the same role, though. That's what I wish.
Oh,
If he was that guy.
If he was Del Griffith?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
That would be
just
cool.
To connect it all. Like, all he does is go around on holidays, driving people home. Like, he's this lonely, weird stalker. And then he becomes a vampire in the end.
Yeah, right. Call back to another episode.
Shared universe.
But yeah, this is a John Hughes movie, which I think a lot of people don't actually remember, oddly enough.
I forgot. For sure.
You forgot?
I forgot.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Okay.
It felt like a time when because he was kind of backing away from directing at this time. And he was not that this movie feels this way at all, but it almost started to feel like he was doing jobs for money or something.
Okay.
Because he didn't seem like, you know, he didn't do the teenager thing anymore. It was kind of, they just felt different. It felt like a different time.
To me, this
is pulling back.
This was always the track in his mind of like Vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Where he wrote like personal disaster movies.
Right.
You know, and this was like that. This was like the last great one he wrote, really, because then he kind of fell into.
After, do you remember?
There's some stuff. Oh no, I'd have to look at IMDb. Yeah. But there's some stuff that isn't as reputable that you probably wouldn't want to say. Hey, John Hughes did this.
John did this too.
Yeah, like he definitely was just doing stuff.
Well, like
for money
Showgirls, I think was a paycheck,
right.
Paycheck movie.
But I mean, like. But, you know, to me, this tracks is the same thing that, like, Vacation is, you know?
Yeah.
Or Christmas Vacation or whatever. Yeah. You know, like, personal horror stories with families.
Yeah.
That are, like, you know.
Oh, the whole time I was watching it this time just, like, from a script. Because I've never watched it from a screenwriting perspective. I've always just enjoyed it. I was like, you can tell that he has kids and he's had these conversations with his children about family
and
frustrated with their not caring about the family matters and things like that. Yeah.
Same with Vacation.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's all there. Same with Christmas Vacation.
So just super quick. These are some movies I see that he wrote. And I
almost don't want you to read this for John.
My jaw is kind of dropping.
I know what you're going to say.
So Flubber. Wrote.
Yep.
101 Dalmatians, Miracle on 34th. This is the post Home Alone credits.
Those are all fine though. I don't.
They all made tons of money. I'm just shocked that he was the guy that did them.
Yeah.
Right.
They don't necessarily feel like they have special John Hughes magic.
Right.
Or something.
Yeah.
To me, and they're great movies. Some people's favorites.
I wouldn't say
ways.
Flubber's great, but I like Flubber.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like
Flubber
me.
Too.
I'm nostalgically. I like
I'm
Flubber.
Sure they have fans. Is my point.
Right.
Home Alone 3.
He wrote Home
Alone. It says written by. Is that true?
It might be characters.
It does. See, Home Alone 2, he has a character by credit. Home Alone 3, it says written by.
Maybe.
Whoa.
I don't know. I'll click on
stuff
it.
Stuff gets stark and you want to make money, Jamie.
Yeah.
You get paid to write. How it is.
I'm just, you know, I didn't write Breakfast Club, though, first. So that's the part that's
weird.
That's true. That's true.
Drillbit Taylor story by.
I did know that.
Made in Manhattan story.
Yep.
I mean, I'm sort of amazed. I mean, all of these are, none of these are like horrible, horrible movies. They're just, they surprise me because they do feel like jobs. They feel like something like me.
You know what,
honestly,
any of those, if you put him behind the camera, I bet they would have had like a different magic about them. But yeah, they don't have the same.
It's also
Johnny's
weird to imagine
thing.
The 300 page. Made in Manhattan.
Made in Manhattan.
By the way, he is the sole writer of Home Alone 3.
How about that?
I mean,
now
money's
I
money.
Now I want to watch it because I've never seen it.
You know what, though? He's doing it for his family, probably.
Hey, I can't, you know, I would have done it. I'll do Home Alone 7 if they call me. I'm out here. Home Alone in Space, I'm all over it.
Home Alone in Space,
I mean,
yes.
Before we
dude,
get
the
into...
Jetsons.
That's right.
Before we get into
Home Alone meets the
big
Jetsons.
Setups and stuff, before
there
we
is.
Start talking about that, I mean, we could talk about how this made John Hughes kind of live off of this family-friendly fare for the next decade.
Yeah, how about that?
But also, I consider Home Alone kind of like a Die Hard, where as in, like, for kids movies, it became Blank meets Home Alone.
Yep, absolutely.
Like you had Blank Check and you had Richie Rich and you just basically had copycats galore of this. So
Blake Snyder, who we talk about all the time, I mean, he kind of fell into the Home Alone meets Blank. In fact, Blank Check was his one movie that was kind of a Home Alone knockoff, I remember.
I saw it in theaters.
I love that movie.
I saw it in theaters, yeah.
That was his big claim to fame, which he made a ton of money off of and got blind script deals after he wrote that movie. So, you know, whatever.
Fucking Blank Check.
Did you know Blake during that time or after?
Not. It was after that time.
After, okay.
But yeah, that was his big one.
I think that's one of the main copycats I can think of. It's just like a kid torturing people with contraptions and things. Yeah, right. Yeah,
exactly.
But this definitely launched that for what? Mm-hmm. I would say like close to a decade.
A decade, yeah. Almost, it feels it, like. Yeah.
There are weird movies that come, even in my recent history, like Taken was one of those movies. Like everybody wanted the next Taken.
Okay.
Like almost the Taken ripoff. I mean, not
Matrix.
Matrix.
Oh, yeah, the Matrix. Definitely. You know. Just
Home Alone is one of those movies.
Yeah, I
agree.
Where
it's so big and so defining.
Yeah.
Where people are like, how do we
replicate this in a different
Lord of the
subgenre.
Rings. How many fantasy movies did we endure that only were one entry because they were trying to restart Lord of the Rings or restart Harry Potter?
Aragorn,
you know?
Or whatever. Not Aragorn, the character. The dragon one?
Aragorn. There was the Terabithia. There was there was the Golden Compass.
Narnia.
Narnia
is probably the second most successful.
And how many? Yeah, you knew because it always had a colon and then a subtitle because they were like, we're gonna
keep it. Right.
Anyway, let's get into the meat. Let's talk about. I know Jimmy's raring.
I got it.
He's got a novel.
If I can make it.
I learned something already on this podcast. I didn't realize all those movies were John Hughes movies.
I didn't either.
Which is pretty sad that I didn't know that.
I'm surprised you didn't, honestly. Yeah, I had no idea. I would think you would be like John Hughes
I think I even read a John Hughes biography at one point. I don't remember that. It's bizarre. Anyway.
Yeah. Let's talk about the opening scene and setups. I think
So this movie has... one of the best setups. I mean, it's pretty incredible when you break it down.
I think of a buffet of remarkable writing things, and the setup is the most amazing of all. Because it's like one big scene, right? One sequence, essentially.
Yeah.
I don't think it has cuts, right?
It's cuts.
I could almost see this sequence going with a floating
camera. But it feels very fluid. Feels fluid.
It almost feels like this one long shot, even though it isn't.
It does.
Yeah.
It does. And
if made today, they probably would have attempted that.
They would have. But steady cam. Yeah.
But it's so well executed, it feels fluid.
By the way, this movie, I should say before we get started, rewatching this, it feels like probably one of the movies that have influenced my own writing the most.
Yeah.
I would say I didn't even realize it until I rewatched it, but I'm like, damn, those Nickelodeon movies. I'm using like beat for beat. Like when I write, by the way, Nickelodeon, Christmas Day, Tiny Christmas, and Santa Hunters.
Hell yeah,
Jamie feature.
Feature. All day long. Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, Nickelodeon.
See if you can spot where he stole things from Home Alone.
That's really incredible.
Tiny Christmas, it has a Home Alone-esque soundtrack the entire time.
Really?
It sounds just... I mean,
like John Hughes' light.
Totally influenced by it. It's really good. The soundtrack's actually really good.
Okay.
Anyway, so there are a lot of things I know I've taken from this. Just up front, I'd say this is one of those screenplays, like Die Hard. You know, we talked about Galaxy Quest that... probably most influenced my own stuff.
How about that?
I really noticed it when I rewatched it this time. I probably could have said it because I come back to it a lot. So I get why everybody wanted the next, you know, Blank Check.
Right.
Well, who wouldn't?
So one thing I wanted to note before I go into this insane breakdown, there are deleted scenes from the opening that would have made it way more fat. Like there's a conversation between the pizza guy and Harry.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
There's like three or four more lines there.
Whoa.
There's a significant amount of the deleted scenes are from that opening. So it's interesting how they realized we're doing so much here. We need to like make it quick. It was like very instructive watching the deleted scenes.
Somebody told me later in my screenwriting career that this particular setup will highlight when you break it down. They told me, they gave me this line. This is one of those quotables. Everything is a setup or a payoff. Somebody once told me that. So everything in your script is either a setup or a payoff. There's nothing else exists in the script. And I think when you read through these, you'll see that everything is a setup.
Absolutely.
I would argue a little bit on that, but I think that you could like look at Reservoir Dogs and say there's definitely things that aren't.
There are certainly... You
know, there's definitely great movies that don't have those.
There are certainly like, you know, the mini plot type movies that sort of go... And every movie is to a degree that, but the more stylized you get in a movie, the more you get to these commercial blockbusters, mm-hmm. you'll see... I don't know that I'd say it's all, but I think it's a good guiding principle if you kind of analyze.
The plant.
Is this a setup or payoff?
Yeah.
It's not. Well, does it belong?
Does it belong?
And then, because it might not belong.
It's, or
and it, sometimes
that's
just
how
like,
I
yeah.
try to write now.
Yeah.
Is I make sure I'm setting something up later and then paying it off. But there are movies that don't do it that are great.
For sure. For sure.
Yeah.
I don't know that I buy the principle just as a tenant. Like, it must be, you know, Robert McGee. It must be a setup and a payoff or shit. You know, get rid of it. You know?
Watch Home Alone.
Right.
Right.
But I will say, you know, a lot of my client scripts are missing this
opening
13-minute opening setup.
Right.
Where every single little tiny moment is a setup for something later. And I think there's something instructive about whenever I'm reading a script that the setups and payoffs just don't work, I automatically go to the third act and all the big moments that are happening. And then I just reverse it. I go back. There's sort of this relationship between first act and third act, you know. I can usually tell by the end all the things that are missing in the beginning.
Right.
It's
almost as if they wrote the third act without reading the first act.
Right.
You know, so they never connected the dots.
Right.
Between the
so two. You have all these major reveals without anything setting
them
up.
Right. Adding, it's like they just keep adding things to it.
And I see this a lot.
Bob once said something about Harry Potter. That would not to bring up Bob's hatred for Harry Potter.
I don't hate Harry Potter. I actually really enjoy Harry Potter, but to me, it's a lot of, I always say this wrong, deus ex machina.
Yeah.
It's like, how do we fix something? Well, there's this thing. And it's like, you're already an hour and 10 minutes in the movie. I'm like, well, what's that thing?
Right.
We didn't even know about that thing.
Right now.
It's all payoff.
Right.
It keeps introducing things to fix the thing.
And people that have read the books know about the setups and the payoffs. Because that thing was probably mentioned in some other part of the book.
Right.
But in the movie, it wasn't. So it's just as a viewer, I'm like, this doesn't work as a movie viewer.
And in those movies, it almost keeps doing that. Like it stacks them.
It pile drives through and it doesn't care what you think.
Yeah, and
so.
I think fantasy tends to do that. Like maybe even Lord of the Rings if you watched it. You know, it's like, where are these birds coming from? I don't know. Why are they here?
Lord of the Rings, the source text wasn't written for like what we're talking about.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like to make those into movies, you had to rewire them.
Okay.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Now that we've stressed the importance of the setup.
Yeah.
Now take us through it.
Okay, so right from the start, Kevin complains, Uncle Frank won't let me watch the movie. So even though we don't see the movie, one of the first lines of the whole movie is about this movie that's too bad for him to watch.
Right.
Okay, so that's set up right there. The dad says to Kevin, how am I supposed to shave in France without a plug adapter? So they're setting up the trip right away.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin says to his dad, they won't let me do anything, Dad. And he says, you want to do something? Pick up those micro machines. Aunt Leslie stepped on one and almost broke her neck.
Right
away, setting up the micro machines.
It's a trap right there.
It's a trap.
Yeah.
Mom tells Dad that Kevin was in the garage playing with the glue gun. He says, didn't we talk about that? And Kevin says, I was making ornaments out of fish hooks. So we set up right there that he's creative and resourceful. Okay.
He's an engineer of sorts.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Harry
so
dressed...
So you can be Jigsaw later. Okay,
Harry dressed as the... Harry dressed... Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God, that article.
Right.
Harry dressed as the cop yells, all kids, no parents. Foreshadowing.
Mm-hmm.
3 minutes in, Kevin says, I don't know how to pack my suitcase. His family tells him he's completely helpless. Les incompetents.
Right.
4.5 minutes... Bombs away. A kid from the top of the stairs throws a suitcase and it lands at Harry's feet, visually setting up the paint cans coming soon.
Mm-hmm. Also, Right. Yeah. Go ahead.
Right. I mean, your brain doesn't realize this, but it's being prepared.
From a directing standpoint, all the things you're saying, too, are constructing the house out. It's not a script thing, but it's a directing thing. But mm-hmm. the geography of the house is laid out in this whole opening yes. so well. If you didn't do this, it wouldn't make sense later. Because that we need to know the house.
We need to know that.
We need to know how the house is figured out.
And that's what I mean. Like, your brain isn't registering that this is a setup. But if you didn't have that moment, those paint cans, it doesn't work as well.
If you didn't see the distance of those stairs.
Well, if you notice also, all these setups almost are happening with some degree of tension or conflict.
Absolutely.
That. So they're all dramatic scenes. It's not just like, because you see people that do this the bad way. And one big advantage this does that I don't see enough of, and I almost always do this, is if you throw us into something that's in motion, it makes it for a lot more entertaining than if you just start, stop.
Right.
You know, like, okay, we're going to turn this on.
This is already going.
They're in a hurry to get to a trip. There's all kinds of chaos.
Oh my gosh.
Thrown into some chaos. And the chaos might not relate really to the bigger story, which is him home alone. But eventually it will, you know, it just throws us in that chaos.
This, you know what this always, I don't know if this is in Jimmy's notes, but what this also establishes character-wise is that the family is oblivious to what's going on.
Right.
Yeah.
They're oblivious to everything happening in the right where the door is.
Right. Right.
And that's really important because it sets up the viability of what's going to happen with the plot.
Yeah, I agree.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we don't really think about it, but you know that they could forget Kevin because they barely have any clue what's happening in their house.
Right. I think the main thing to point out is it's in the construction. Like, this is deliberate. Yes. This is planned. And this is why it works. This is why your brain responds to the way when the things start happening in the payoff mode. It only works because of these little things, you know?
Yeah. Don't die, Jimmy.
I'm going to make it, guys. I'm going to make it. Okay. So back into it. 4.5 minutes. He says, when I grow up, I'm living alone. 5 minutes. The tarantula is introduced. Buzz, who's going to feed your spider when we're gone? And then what's awesome is I loved this touch. And I imagine this is in the script, too. In the background behind Buzz, the BB gun hangs on the wall. Even though it's not talked about, we see it. It's like right there in the middle of the screen. Mm-hmm. So we set up the BB gun.
Do you think that was written in?
Absolutely.
You think so?
Yeah. Behind Buzz, a BB gun BB hangs on the wall.
Right. Okay.
5.5 minutes, the old man Marley story. It makes Kevin afraid, and it's sort of opposite thematic. He murdered his whole family.
Right. Even the shovel is there. Mm-hmm. That shovel.
Also, sets. Stop touching the mic. it also sets up Kevin's fears. He's a kid with a lot of fears.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Good call.
He's a kid. Like, that's the first thing he's afraid of when we learn. He's going to be afraid of a few more things later.
Yeah, that sort of is the scene where they show how afraid he is of everything.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Whether it be furnaces or...
All that stuff. Yeah. 7 minutes, the pizza delivery guy comes, knocks over the statue, setting up all of those future pizza delivery gags.
Yeah.
8 minutes, pizza guy says to Harry, are you just here for the holidays? And he says, I guess he could say that. 8.5 minutes. Any of you, the Mr. McAllister who lives here, and then Harry tells his dad that there's break-ins around the holidays and wants to make sure they did the precautions, and he sets up the we've got time lights, we've got locks, we're good. So that's
also important to note, if this is the first time you're watching it, Harry's a cop right now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's important to know. Like, we've all seen it so many times, it doesn't, you know.
Yeah. But no, I know.
Right now, Joe Pesci is a cop.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's so awesome. All this stuff is happening so fast. 9 minutes. Family dinner. No room for Kevin. And they announce right there that they're leaving at 8 a.m. 10 minutes.
And you see the tickets.
Yeah, you see. Well, I'm bringing up
the tickets. Oh, you bring them.
Yeah.
Jimmy has a list.
I fucking broke this down.
He broke this shit down.
You know what's funny? He's got this huge list, and he's probably still missing them. You know?
I know. Because there's so many. There's so much.
The character moments that you're not talking, like, you can't. That'd be a long list. Yeah, yeah. There's so many little character things.
The little character beats. Right. Yeah.
It's almost like it could be a Where's Waldo to find the moments that don't set up something, that don't get recalled.
Yeah, there's so much that gets recalled.
I'm almost surprised this isn't more often noted as a teaching movie.
Oh, it's a great one for it, especially for
I never hear people talk like say you should watch Home
Alone. You should watch Home Alone and how they're constructed. Yeah. So 10 minutes, Kevin attacks Buzz for eating his cheese pizza, chaos ensues, his ticket and passport get drenched in spilled milk and accidentally thrown away. So that's a great 10-minute hook right there. Mm-hmm. Like that is the catalyst for all of this. Like 11 minutes, the whole family is mad at Kevin. 11 minutes and 10 seconds, the cop, Harry, flashes his gold tooth at Kevin. Gold tooth established.
Yeah.
That matters because all the gold tooth stuff resonates with you because of this first moment.
They even put a little sound effect in it.
Ding. Ding.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I love that. 12 minutes, Kevin says, everyone in this family hates me. Mom says, then maybe you should ask Santa for a new family. 12 and a half minutes. Kevin says, I don't want a family. Family suck. I don't want to see any of you for the rest of my life. And mom says, you'd feel pretty sad if you woke up tomorrow and you didn't have a family. And then he says, I hope I never see any of you jerks again. I wish you would just disappear. And then 1 minute later, they're all asleep. Overnight, the wind knocks out the power and the phone lines.
Yep.
So 13 minutes.
13 minutes, which...
The phone lines being an important thing.
Absolutely.
Right?
Generally, you hear about that inciting incident being the 12-minute mark or something.
Yeah.
And really, the funny thing is, this movie almost hints at it being like an out-of-the-bottle movie. You know, when we talk about the Blake Snyder genres, even though it's not magic per se, it's kind of like a Christmas wish gone wrong. Like,
No, it's...
And they do. I mean, even the how... Christopher Columbus shoots it, like zooming in on stuff.
Totally.
And it has this kind of magical feel. Mm-hmm. It's almost Scrooge-esque or something.
Yeah. I told you guys in the commentary, he talks how he wanted the whole movie to be Dickensian. He uses that word.
Yes.
That the whole movie is, he wants to feel like a Christmas carol.
When you said that, then.
Yeah, he says it on that on the disc.
Especially that part. It just feels 100% like this Christmas wish that suddenly, you know, the Christmas powers intervene.
He gets his wish.
He's Scrooge and Harry and Marv are the ghosts.
Right. So Scrooge never, well, I guess he kind of gets a happy moment when he sees the past and stuff, but, you know.
Kind of.
But he, and one thing I would say, I don't, well, we'll talk about it when we get to the fun and games section, which we could just jump into, right?
Yeah.
Well, like the one thing I put this on the list here, Jamie. The one thing I wanted to talk about was the fact that Kevin breaks the fourth wall.
Yeah.
Right when he realizes that his family's gone. I always thought that was kind of a.
There's multiple moments where he's staring directly into the camera. Yeah.
Right. I don't really have an answer for what that is, but what do you guys think that is?
I do think that's interesting.
I think it's a Ferris Bueller callback. No.
Yeah.
He becomes
Ferris. Well, I did write that, Ferris Bueller. Yeah, is that just, that's the John Hughes style thing. I'm sure that was in the script.
Oh, absolutely. Right at the audience.
I made my family disappear.
Yeah, I made my family disappear.
Yeah. I guess that function always, to me, I guess when I saw this, I was Kevin's age.
Right.
I was literally his age. Like, I think Macaulay Culkin is 36 now. So, So I don't know. Like, I guess that's like an identifying thing.
Yeah, but. I don't know. I haven't really thought about the fourth wall aspect of how
it's there though, it's and it's absolutely it's like there. Something a lot of people don't talk about that there's a fourth wall break.
Yeah,
there's three of them. I think
There's one where he's upstairs. There's multiple moments where he's like running through that hallway and he like
right at the camera, right. Yeah. And there's nothing there otherwise for him to be doing that, right. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't really have a, you know,
an answer
reason,
for that,
but I like it.
I think it's a good point.
Oh, I don't think it's a mistake.
It works really well. Yeah. It's definitely intentional.
It seems to, but I think when I wrote that down I was thinking, man, that's a really great way to have the audience identify with the character.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, literally looks at you.
Yeah.
And then you're down with him.
I think it's meant to say that.
He's been a brat up until that moment.
Yeah. And then House of Cards ripped it off years later.
I haven't seen House of Cards.
I've never seen House of Cards.
He talks to the camera.
Oh, does he? Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay.
But he directly addresses.
Sorry, the listeners will get that.
But seriously, the whole,
he just kind of walks out of a scene. And
throughout the whole amazing setup that Jimmy just broke down, Kevin isn't exactly a likable character by the end of that.
No.
And I feel like that moment right there kind of really butters you up, because it's like, you know, when somebody stares at you and says something, you're like,
yeah,
okay, I'm with you now.
I think that's a good point. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just talking about the genius of John Hughes, maybe, I guess.
There's a weird thing about him. Like, I don't even know that he has a save the cat moment or anything like that. Like, he doesn't have, does he have any nicey-nice moments where it's like, oh, we'll root for this kid? I think the mere fact that he is a cute kid and there's something funny and quirky about him.
Yeah.
You're just on board.
He's still innocent.
Yeah.
He's innocent. He's young enough to be innocent.
Yeah.
Like, you're not screw the kid, I hope he dies.
Well, the rooting,
because we all know that we wished our family would fucking right. go away at some point, and that's
The rooting influence gets built into his creativity and his sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
Those things in the second act.
Right.
Right.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I just wanted to bring that up, guys.
No, I think it's a good
it's
point.
It's a very interesting piece of this
it's
movie.
It's really true.
Yeah.
The one thing, the wish fulfillment thing, the interesting thing about the fun and game section, this has a true fun and game section. So a lot of people misconstrue the fun and game section to always think it should be like Home Alone, where he's literally enjoying the wish fulfillment,
yeah.
you know? And really, that's not, like, if a horror movie has fun and games, fun and games is really more the fun and games for the audience,
yeah.
in my opinion. It's the reason we come to see the movie, the trailer, the promise of the premise.
If I could give an example, it's Jeff Goldblum having sex after he turns into the fly. Remember, no, you know what I mean? Like, he gets to the fly and then he needs to have like rampant sex in order, but that's fun and games. He's got his new powers now.
Definitely.
And then it's then, you know.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, is that
it's
not
true.
Yeah.
That, no, you're right.
But it's dark, whereas this isn't. Yeah.
On the flip side in a movie like on a flip side, in a movie like, I don't know, Night of the Living Dead, let's say, it could be zombies attacking and them on the run. They're
right,
not necessarily
right.
enjoying themselves. Right. And then on Dawn of the Dead, it might be them enjoying themselves.
I brought the fly up.
I don't know.
The fly I brought up because it was his discovery.
Right.
It wasn't that he was exactly like, he knew something was different and he's discovering it.
Yeah.
Where it's not exactly fun times, right. you know.
So, but in this movie, and a lot of these wish fulfillment movies, it is kind of fun times. So, if you go to like Bruce Almighty, which is a movie I quote far too often in these conversations, but it's like him enjoying being God
before
it turns, or What Women Want, which I barely remember, but I'm sure it's about him using his powers for evil, and you know, it's probably not great movie into the Me Too movement or something. I don't know, maybe
Mel Gibson's in it too, so it pretty much doesn't hold up that at all.
In Click, which I never saw, I'm sure it's him clicking on people.
See it either.
Yeah, no, I've seen Click. Yeah, that's
and making his life better.
Click is Christmas Carol retold.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
what it is. Yeah.
So you know, I'm sure it has all the it. In this movie, has that classic funny game.
This is literally him. Having fun.
Exactly.
Eating ice cream, jumping on the bed.
Yeah.
The one thing I wanted to mention about it, though, so funny games, a lot of times it's like this 25-minute section. It's funny, when I teach screenwriting and we go through these kind of classic structures and we talk about funny games, a lot of students will only put like one sentence for this, and they'll be way short on the funny games. And the problem is, this is really the section that is the heart of the movie. This is why people are coming to see the movie in extent. They're getting all kinds of other things.
It's also the best character building moment.
Yep.
It's the
showing them in this new, like you said, discovery. Discovery is a really way great way to conceptualize it.
I think a good example, too, would be, what's the movie? Damn it, I just forgot the name of it. Never mind. Mm-hmm. It's a movie with the telekinesis, the found footage movie. What is that?
Oh, Chronicle?
Chronicle.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the discovery scenes in that are amazing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And sorry, I forgot the name.
So I even see shorts that make this problem. And shorts can, because they're more experimental. But I see shorts that do all this setup. They give you 1 second of the actual concept of the movie. And then they either end or go somewhere else. It's kind of, shorts can do that. But just remember,
short structure is different.
Short structures.
Yeah.
Can be different.
Yeah.
It can be. But in these fun and games sections, one of the techniques I learned early on was I actually divide my fun and games. I put a midpoint in there. And then I realized that so does half of the structure people. They put a midpoint. And the thing Sid Field calls a pinch point is actually the midpoint of a fun and games section. And the only guidance he gives is it kind of hints at the major conflict that will come later in the game. So in this case, we touch in with the two thieves, and they're looking at the house. I don't remember the exact moment, but
they're following him,
all that stuff.
And he runs away from them.
Just a little hint that even though he's having this fun, there's a big conflict coming our way.
It shifts to the second half of the fun and game shifts to him fooling the thieves.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Calm Before the Storm, maybe. Maybe give it a term that we all love. Yeah, well, these terms. You know.
That's good. Right. The terms.
The terms.
So my advice there is, when you're watching, and this movie does it, is when you're writing your fun and game section, we're conceiving it. First of all, remember, it's about 25 pages, and it's the part of the movie that people are coming to see. So make it good. But secondly, to help you brainstorm it, put in a midpoint like this that has some kind of shift, some kind of hint at the conflict.
At the main conflict. Yeah. That's really good. And I will second what you said about your students with my clients. Often, instead of 25 pages of fun and games, it'll be one page. Yeah. With a montage, and that's it. Yes.
They think it's the montage.
It's that's like, the they're like, I got the montage in there. Right. But it's like, no, each of these scenes, each of these like sentences in the montage should be a scene in itself. No,
that's an excellent point, because this is the place where you do get those montages often. And if you're going to have them, there still has to be something else.
Right.
It's not just the montage.
If you're going to have the montage, you need to have additional fun and games.
And your point is well taken. Like, this whole section could have just been a quick montage that happens in 5 minutes, but it can also be a bunch of scenes.
It is
like
a montage, sort of. It does montage a little bit.
It feels like a montage,
and then
it's
broken by Harry and Marv being outside, which is also a reveal and a payoff at the same time that Harry was not a cop. And he says their plan in the van while they're staring at the houses.
Perfect. That's exactly.
That's a payoff right there in the middle of fun and games.
Good call.
That's
right. Yeah. There's your pinch point.
The pinch point.
But no, I think a lesser version of this would be 1 minute. Imagine if you didn't have.
I've seen that. So I know exactly what you're
saying. So, like, instead of having him, like, the whole shopping scene and then the shoplifting stuff, that would be like 5 seconds long.
That would be a 5 second part of, and there'll be music playing in the background.
Yeah, exactly. And like that.
A Christmas tune.
So to your point, I agree. Like, it should be long. Like, it's not this one sentence thing you skip over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think, you know, saying that it is why people come to the movie, especially a comedy.
Right.
This genre specifically. You want to revel in that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you're making a horror movie or something, I get. Maybe not reveling as
much. Nah, man, that's all the kills.
I watched Bad Moms Christmas this morning. And Bad Moms Christmas.
How was the fun and game section?
So the
Jamie?
Fun and game section was like.
By the way, I can't laugh. I'm incapable of laughing right now. So it's just. So I'm finding this funny.
So Bad Moms Christmas, which was almost as instructional as Home Alone, featured not one, but five montages in the fun and game section. That's basically what it was.
Five montages. Five.
So the whole movie is just fun and games.
Bad Moms Christmas montage. It was kind of. The whole movie is fun and games. That's basically.
Once they all made their wish to be bad moms.
Oh, my gosh.
And it came true.
That's right. Next week on the podcast.
Right. Bad Moms Christmas.
Okay. Yeah. That's all I wanted to say about fun and games, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah.
Work that section.
The actual fun and games is him watching the grown up gangster movie, full reign of the house with no rules. He's eating ice cream. Mm-hmm. You know, he's shooting the toys with the BB gun. He's sledding out the front door. He's taking a shower in his parents' bathroom and using his dad's aftershave. He's buying pizza and scaring away the pizza guy.
And you can imagine all these things being in a trailer for this movie.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Kevin McAllister's Home Alone.
Home Alone.
Boom, we see all these quick clips.
Yeah.
And that's what this section is. It's often lots of trailer moments, some of the funniest scenes in the movie.
Also kind of seems like the log line.
It's pretty much the log line.
Yeah.
I think
what would you do if you're home alone?
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
For the first time.
For the first time.
As
a
kid.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'd act like your dad is shaving.
Exactly. You'd follow him. Yeah.
You put on the chemicals on your face.
You'd watch that tape that nobody will let you watch because you're not old enough.
In a different movie, that would have been a porn. That would absolutely be porn. Yeah. So now we're going to.
Which would have made for the pizza scene being really weird.
Oh, yeah, right? My gosh.
Come on in. Are you the pizza guy?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
That is a great idea for another movie. This is really a great idea.
We could just edit him in with that. And right.
Wow. Let's talk about characters and comic obsessions. You seem like you wanted to there, Jimmy.
So I was.
Jimmy's the comic obsession guy.
Yeah. So yeah.
We need his own theme music.
I'll add that in later. Yeah.
So, oh, dude, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I'm probably not going
to. So yeah, this is the. Do you want to go? Oh, the comic obsession. This was from a Robert McKee. We've talked about this in a couple episodes. Robert McKee says that in a comedy, all of the comedic situations are grown out of a character's like blind comic obsession, right?
Yeah.
And so we've been tracking that when we've been doing the comedies recently, and I found three in this movie. Mm-hmm. I don't think every character has them. Like Kevin doesn't have one. His mom doesn't have one. His dad doesn't have one. But
Kevin kind of his obsession with being an adult and self-reliant.
That's true.
That's being why he acts like his dad and puts his aftershave on. That's a
good point.
Sorry, I didn't mean to undercut you.
No, that could be good.
You know what I mean? Like Kevin kind of comes off like he wants to be a grown up.
He's obsessed with being a kid trying to be an adult.
I don't need my family. That's his whole deal. But go ahead. Sorry.
Dude, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really plays in that.
Yeah, it applies to everything. The shopping, the shaving, you know, all these different
things. That's awesome.
And for the most part, he is. Mm-hmm. He's just halfway there, you know.
I learned something.
There you go. Teaching podcast.
Uncle Frank, his obsession is being cheap. He at the beginning they're like, "Honey, pay for the pizzas," and he says, "All I have are traveler's checks." And then on the plane, he's like, "Can I get some champagne? It's free, right?" And then like later they find out that the salt and pepper shakers are crystal, and he's like, "Put those in your purse." He has an obsession with being cheap.
Right.
John Candy's obsession is that his band is famous. Like all of his things that he's talking about are how famous his band is. Yeah. And he's not. Marv is the Wet Bandits. His blind obsession. His obsession is that they are this like infamous duo of like criminals, and he's got to leave his calling card wherever they go.
He's a fame whore.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, once again, it did come up in another comedy. We find these characters. And all the comedy around their characters is built around these obsessions. So I think it works.
Think it's an important function to have people that play off their obsessions.
Like, yeah,
you know, because you got Harry telling him he's sick for doing that.
Yeah,
he's sick for you know flooding the houses you're and sick. Everything. Yeah, right. And then you've got like Frank's wife who goes along with it because she's his wife, even though she's obviously not down with it.
Yeah,
you know. So you have to have somebody to play off the obsession.
That's a good call. To make it work.
To make it work.
To point out.
To point out that they are
obsessed. To point out they're obsessed.
Yeah, right.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just, ever since we've been looking at this, I've been really like, wow, it's consistent, you know? Mm-hmm. And it really does work. So, yeah.
No, I love that. I love that. I have to start using it myself.
Well, let's talk about characters. I mean, that kind of goes with the characters.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
some of those
yeah.
are, like, Frank, while he's... cheap. He's not. I wouldn't say he's a main character.
No.
He kind of doesn't serve as much of a function.
Still, it works for those lesser characters too. For sure.
Buzz. Buzz. You could even say Buzz's comic obsession is torturing his brother.
Yeah, that's true.
He wouldn't tell him that story otherwise. You know. True. Yeah. Yeah. But he's only hinted at.
If you were growing on my ass.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, all the characters feel so well defined, but we're not with them. This is like Castaway. You know. Like,
yeah.
It's like as soon as that plane goes down.
It's just Thomas.
It's just, yeah, we're just with Kevin, really.
Yeah.
So I mean, there's not much to say there, I guess. Really. B stories and theme.
Yeah, well, I think there's several B stories going.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the interesting thing I heard was that the one B story was added, the guy with the shovel, surprisingly.
Interesting.
Robert's Blossom?
Yeah, Christopher Columbus. Is it Christopher Columbus, or did they just call him
Chris?
Yeah, it sounded weird when I said
separate
it.
Him from the...
Yeah, well, he discovered America, and then he did the Gremlins or something.
Right, and then he wrote Gremlins.
Gremlins.
Yeah.
So he wanted more sentimentality to the script or something, so he asked for that to be added, apparently, after the fact. Which is interesting, because this movie is kind of loaded with a couple different B stories. Like, you know, it has that story. It has the mom, of course, tricking him. But then it also has a great, like... the caper story, it almost works on its own separate thing. Like they really establish the villains with a you know, their plan is actually really clever and things
like that. Right. I did want to talk about that. How I think I wrote it in the thing, how Harry and Marv, while they're kind of silly, they're not idiots.
Yeah.
Their plan's good. Yeah. And it would have worked completely.
Yeah. I think it actually, by making their plan so good, because it's always, you always want to say the victory is only as strong as the obstacles overcome to get it. So by making them good criminals, it makes Kevin even better hero.
Also, they, Harry and Marv learn. You know what I mean? Like, even though they're wrong, like, you know, at the end, he's like, he wants us to go back down through the House of Horrors.
Yeah.
And we're not going to do that. We're going to cross on this. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
They are trying and they are learning.
Yeah.
They're just wrong.
And I think that's a good lesson there, because a lesser script wouldn't have had that.
They would just be idiots straight through.
They would just be suffering blindly and continue to fall into all of the traps.
Right.
But if you make your villains just as smart as your hero, then it makes the whole thing better.
And putting Joe Pesci in this as well is kind of like, he's a dangerous guy. You know, even though he's kind of silly, that silliness is what makes him dangerous. I mean, look at, you know, like something like Goodfellas. Or
it's
the same year.
Same year.
That's a crazy
year for Joe Pesci.
Yeah. So you put him in this and he's still dangerous. And I always say that in these comedies, in Galaxy Quest was a good example, you got to make the villain seem at least a little scary. Like,
right.
Like that villain, he might actually bite Kevin's finger off.
Yeah, you know? You could believe that.
You sort of want to believe that. Even though
they just don't have the chance. You can't ever let them have the chance. Yeah. But would they kill a kid? Maybe.
Maybe. I think they would.
They're lowlifes.
Yeah.
So you have to make, I think it works. It makes the comedy all the more spicier when you can have the scary with it a little bit. At least a little bit. I mean, nobody's going to be scared or hiding their eyes in this movie. It's not like Phil the Animal where we'd all hide our eyes. No, we wouldn't.
Well, to go back to what you were saying a little bit, because when we started this, you're talking about how they added the Roberts Blossom part.
Mm-hmm.
The old man.
Yep.
And I think that was a good choice because Kevin needed someone to bounce off of.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have that the whole movie. And that he kind of serves as like his faux family for a moment.
Yeah, he's a
and like I'm surprised that wasn't in there originally because it seems so important.
Absolutely.
Because he kind of teaches him the meaning of family.
Well,
you know,
Go into the theme. We can jump into that a little bit.
Yeah.
But I actually think, you know, his B story is the theme. Like the other characters don't have the B stories.
Yeah.
Specifically,
because he's an old Kevin.
He's an old Kevin.
He's old. Yeah.
And Kevin ultimately is teaching him the lesson, and he's teaching Kevin the lesson at the same time.
They teach each other,
and, you know, Kevin's arc, in my opinion, is the kind of like, you're all jerks, I don't want to see you all ever again, to a kid who wants to see them again. You know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what the old man's arc is, too. He's kind of given up on the fact, like, oh, I'm not going to bother. I'm not going to make the phone call to a person that makes the phone call. So, yeah, to me, that arc seems like, I would have almost thought that B story was the first one.
Right, like the story was built around them.
To go back with the Charles Dickens analogy, like Kevin's kind of looking at the ghost of Christmas Future, maybe.
Definitely. Right.
The guy who doesn't talk to, the old man who's lonely, doesn't talk to his family anymore, is possibly him one day.
It's the circus mirror version of himself.
You got that, he's kind of like a spirit warning.
That's so good.
Isn't that?
That's so good.
It's so good. Well done.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's almost, I can't believe we're talking about Home Alone.
No.
it's so good.
It's really well constructed. Well, he's a good example. I mean, Jamie, I'm sure you use these all the time. Mm-hmm. He's a window character.
Mm-hmm.
Old Man Marley. Like you, a lot
he's
of
named
times.
Marley for a reason.
Oh my gosh.
Jacob
Marley. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just got
come
that.
On.
God, what's wrong with
me? I know, like it's right there.
It's right there. a lot of scripts I read, they don't use the supporting characters as windows into what's emotionally happening with the main character.
Right, right.
And that is exactly his function. Mm-hmm. Like Old Man Marley gives us an opportunity to hear out of Kevin's mouth, just like you said, how he's feeling.
Right.
Right? And and how he's changing. Like he is the way we're allowed to see how Kevin's perspective is changing about family.
Mm-hmm.
Also, blow your mind a little bit, he's also an example of Kevin telling Kevin not to be afraid.
Yeah.
Because Kevin was
He is his
afraid.
Greatest fear.
He's his greatest fear, and it turns out that his greatest fear is his best friend.
Yeah.
Like, right. It's like, yeah, it serves so many
his
functions.
Ally, yeah.
Right, don't be afraid. Yeah.
But, yeah, so when you have these supporting characters, like...
You mentioned something, too, confessional scenes, because he kind of relates to that.
Yeah, so my favorite confessional scene ever is in Toy Story. It is the moment where Woody is like underneath a like plastic crate, and it actually his face is lit like a confessional. Mm-hmm. So, and it's the moment where Woody, basically, the function of a confessional scene is you have these moments in these movies where the hero basically says, "This is all my fault." They accept that their faults and their limitations are like what got them into this situation. And that is like what leads to their change, their arc. It's like it basically happens right before the arc. Right. So in this movie, this is like the perfect example because it's in a church.
Right. Yeah.
And he basically says to old man Marley, like, "I was an asshole. Like I wished my family away and I wished that I could have them back." And then and then after that, he tells the old man he should do the same thing. And then he goes to Santa.
Right.
And that's the big arc moment for me.
Yeah. And usually those happen. This movie's a little, I wouldn't say it's different, but the way they usually happen after the All Is Lost moment and that Dark Night of the Soul.
Yeah.
Right before Act Three.
Yeah.
So the confession kind of gives them the ability to go on to Act Three and be a warrior.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Like, but you need that moment where they accept it, they admit it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The truth is kind of internalized. And exactly. Now they can go and improve. They're a new person.
I wonder if that when they changed the script with the old man, if that the Santa part wasn't, wasn't cut down significantly.
Yeah.
I bet that scene with Santa was way
Santa
more
Santa must have been the confessional
he was
scene.
The, yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because when I watched the Santa scene this time, and I love the Santa scene, I was kind of wondering.
I love
like,
that guy. I love what, that actor. Yeah,
that whole scene, just the way it's done, I love it. You know,
yeah.
I think,
yeah,
oh,
so
I know,
much.
I know how the scene
gotta have a tic-tac here somewhere.
Yeah,
yeah.
I got a tic-tac.
To me, it's
great.
It's almost questionable if it needs to be there, you know, from the overall.
From the
I would have kept it too. But when I watched it this time, I was like, huh, that's like Santa's the mentor character here, but now we have the old man who's the mentor, you know, is this really needed? And I'm glad they kept it. But it was, I agree with your point. I wonder if Santa was kind of that scene, the confessional.
Yeah. And then they trimmed it down after they added the
Marley. After they added that.
Yeah. I bet you're right.
But it also works because Kevin is obviously a very believing, superstitious child. And Santa to him is real.
It communicates to the audience that once and for all, he wished for his family.
He's seeking out who he needs to talk to. Right. So it works for his character.
And sometimes those Dark Knight of the Souls can be multiple scenes.
Yeah, agree.
Yeah.
So it's fine.
I'm not saying it was bad. It just now occurs to me that it might have been meteor.
Yeah,
in a different draft or something.
Right. I think you're right. I bet the whole scene was him saying to Santa, like, "I wished my family away,
in
and
turn,
now I want them back."
In turn, they might have turned him into kind of a sleazy Santa, because since the sentimentality was taken care of with Marley, they just they turned him into kind of a sleaze ball, which is great.
It is great.
He's basically bad Santa like 20 years before bad
exactly.
Santa. Exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's so true.
It's perfect. Yeah.
What did we actually say? The theme?
Like, yeah, I was gonna. That's what I was about to ask. Like,
you know, I
be careful what you wish for.
I honestly think it's like I didn't like write it out to figure it out, but I do think it's something about going from like respecting the family or appreciating your family. Because now we haven't talked about the mother's journeys, and then maybe that fits in too. I don't think
she's in a different movie to get to the movie we're in.
Yeah, what do you think her? Because she kind of almost has her own journey. I don't know that she has anything to learn.
Yeah.
I almost think she has to be patted on the back like you're an okay mom or something. Like it's a battle for respect to build, like
for
she thinks
forgiveness,
she's a bad mom.
Self-forgiveness.
Yeah, self-forgiveness almost.
Yeah.
Less
and they use the John Candy character telling the story about leaving his kid at the funeral parlor.
Kind of like we make mistakes.
Like,
we're human.
Hey, you're
doesn't mean you're a bad person.
Yeah, like you're doing the best you can. Although I don't necessarily agree. I think is really shitty parenting, but
yeah, she's not the best. But also, what you said, like John Candy isn't hit the function of him telling her that.
Absolutely, they're trying to say
is absolving her of this egregious absolutely. Sin that she should never commit again. Right, she will
learning to yeah to forgive herself. Seven she more will.
Times right.
Six more times. Yeah.
It, assuming that this movie was going to be a self-contained one-er. Yeah. It works.
You know, it works really
like
well.
Like, she's absolved. Yeah. John Candy is the angel absolving her of this sin that she will never break again.
That's a really good way to put him as an angel.
Yeah. Because I think by the time she gets to the house, she's like, okay, I know how to be a better mom now. You know, I'm never going to let that happen again. Yeah. And I got through it and my son is okay. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know that how to tuck that into your family may be problematic, but you'll miss them when you're gone kind of theme. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like one of these themes where...
So I said, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, kind of that's thing. In there. I think there's multiples. I think it's like Galaxy Quest. When we were talking about Galaxy Quest, we couldn't put our finger on it. Mm-hmm. And I think this movie is very similar. Like you said, be careful what you wish for.
I also wrote down adversity breeds self-reliance.
That's the moral premise. I love that.
You think that's the moral premise?
Yeah. Okay. But I think it's really, really simple. And that is family should be together at Christmas. And that is told through.
I think you could take Christmas off of there.
Yeah. Well, it's all, you know what?
See, that's where it gets to my theme a little bit. Like, appreciate your family.
Yeah.
Don't overestimate. I'm struggling and putting the words around it. But what I realized with this movie is all Christmas movies are this heightened metaphor for an overall theme about family. They're really themes about family. Not necessarily themes about Christmas, but they use Christmas to heighten it.
Gotcha.
To make it be, because that is a time when we reflect on these things.
Yeah.
So, but what I realized was all these Christmas movies, and for that matter, it could be Thanksgiving movies. They're just an opportunity to have this talk about family overall.
Yeah.
If I could frame it a little bit out of my own personal experience. Family, you could make a theme out of. Family are the people you have to be with, not the ones you chose to, but you should still appreciate them.
Yeah. That is perfect.
And that's what a lot of these movies are hinting at, because we always see the scene where everyone's just like fed up, like home for the holidays or Christmas with the cranks or whatever.
Bad Mom's Christmas.
Yeah.
Where or Christmas Vacation is a great example when all the family shows up and it's like a headache inducing.
Santa Hunters Tiny Christmas playing on Nickelodeon this Christmas.
As Jamie Nash's classic double feature.
That is so awesome. Seriously.
His Home Alone inspired double feature.
We're sitting with a man who has two movies playing on Christmas on Nickelodeon.
Christmas. We should be more famous by proxy.
Dude. How come you're not more famous, Jamie?
Because they're playing on Nickelodeon, I guess. I don't
know. No, that's amazing.
That's great,
man. Home Alone 7. Home Alone 7 in space.
Yes. Let's do it.
Spaceship Alone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm telling you.
Space Station Alone.
Jetsons meets Home Alone. There you go.
It basically would be like the cosmonaut in Armageddon.
Yeah.
He's just alone on a fucking space station. And you tell his story.
Actually, Moon, I think.
Moon's a good one, too. Yes. Yeah.
Home Alone meets Moon.
Home Alone. That's such a good movie right there.
Turns out the burglars are just him.
We got it. We got it. Aliens attack the space station.
Oh, dude, that's awesome. Yeah, the aliens are really just him in his own mind.
Blake Snyder wrote it back in the 90s, to be honest.
Right.
I'm sure he tried.
What was it? What was the James Bond movie, Skyfall, that has that whole sequence that was basically Home Alone?
It was him setting traps and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Remember? Yeah. And everyone.
It was in his house.
I remember people photoshopping, like Daniel Craig on
the thing. It barely made sense. Like, he went back to his old home just to battle the bad guys. I don't know. It's like.
I remember that being like a meme, Skyfall being a Home Alone.
I never saw it.
Oh. Well, never mind then.
Shame on me.
The question is, do we have anything left to say about this amazing script?
So the one thing my one argument on the but you guys have convinced me about the themes and I agree with you.
Jimmy's losing his voice.
I'm barely hanging on, man. It's suspenseful, guys. Ready? Right. I'm gonna say something very important. No, okay. Everybody in the movie who's heroic and sympathetic represents family. And then the villains represent possessions. So for me, that was informing the fact that, like, Christmas is about family and not about possessions. It just seemed like so hammered home with them. Mm-hmm. And then the scene in the church, you know, they're just talking about how Christmas family should be together at Christmas. So I felt like he was really trying to say, like, that's what the theme of this movie is, family versus possessions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I buy it.
You buy it?
Oh, yeah. That sounds, yeah. Also, one of the best, I think, I don't remember if it was a tweet or a Facebook post, but one of the best things I ever read was somebody describing why they thought Home Alone was body horror. Which, whoa, I thought was something I never thought about, you know, but you know, yeah, what I'm talking about, right? And I was like, and they were like, just think about the nail going through the foot.
Oh,
and I was,
God,
like, you're right. You know what? And then them getting hit in the face. I was like, this is a movie that evokes feelings I have when watching horror movies.
Oh, yeah.
Because I actually cringe,
yeah,
those scenes.
That's where I would debate it. I mean, it's not like Jason is body horror, and it's the same kind of cringy, yeah, stuff. So I don't know if I'd go with the body horror.
It's the same thing. It's like a Jigsaw theory. But,
I love the expression on his face, like, body horror, get out of here.
Come on.
Well, Bob already bought up The Fly on this podcast. So I know.
I'm just trying to, like, curve
really
it.
Trying to.
Damn,
I'm trying.
Bob.
Shuffle.
Dude, we got a horror listening
audience.
Making
it dark. Yeah. Did you guys ever see Better Watch Out?
Did not see it yet.
I don't think
it's a good movie. I'm going to plug it. It actually is a horror movie, and it's kind of structured around Home Alone existing,
right,
as a movie.
Oh, okay.
So they actually comment on some stuff that happens in this movie, but in a horror sense.
Whoa, okay.
And it is quite horrific,
yeah,
what happens. So I'm not going to spoil,
okay,
anything, but that's I really enjoyed Better Watch Out.
I was, yeah, going to say, not to rush wrapping this up, but the one lesson I would give from this that I was thinking is, you know, you can take these concepts, horror and comedy especially, go hand in hand. So you can easily say, you know, what's Groundhog Day, the horror movie?
Yeah.
And then come up with Happy Death Day.
It's almost a horror movie. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And then this movie, you know, is a home invasion movie that could,
yeah,
you know, Your Next could have been the horror version or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I've definitely,
like,
heard
that,
comparisons with Your Next before. Yeah.
There were a lot, like when that home invasion spate came, there were a lot of people that were doing the ultra
Panic
violent
Room,
Home Alone and,
yeah,
stuff like that. And that even before.
The Purge 1 is a,
exactly,
home invasion. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Lessons, Jimmy?
The lesson that I learned is that Kevin does have a blind comics obsession, and that is,
yeah,
that he wants to be an adult. I think that works really well, and I think all the comedy is derived out of that. So, yeah.
And the lesson I learned is that rewatching it for this podcast and then listening to you two talk is that setup is maybe the most important thing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think as a kid or even as an adult I realized how good that first 12 minutes
13
yeah, minutes is, like, it's just solid.
There is not a wasted second in those 13
minutes.
Not
at all. No, no.
Every single line, it's insane.
Yeah, no, it's like, it's straight up artistry at that point. It's amazing.
I almost wish somebody out there in YouTube land would make a, like, super cut of the setups with the payoffs adjacent to it, because I'd like to show that to my students.
Yeah.
Somebody make that.
Well, I did send you guys that video. He does cover that.
Yeah.
He does.
The Patrick Willems. He in his video, he covers all the he shows them, mm-hmm, the setups and then the payoffs.
I don't know. Maybe I should just give that as an assignment to my students.
Yeah.
Watch Home Alone,
yeah,
and do this. Make a chart. You know.
You could easily do it, too.
Yeah.
It's so obviously
you would learn
there.
So much. Yeah.
Yeah.
And right. Don't make your fun and games section one page.
Oh, please don't.
Yeah. Trailer moments. Stretch them out. Make them scenes, not sentences in a montage.
You want the audience to have fun, too.
Yeah. That's why we come.
Yeah. Anything else, guys? I think that's it, right?
That's it.
Hell, oh. I know.
The fly
wait,
one
wait.
More time?
I want to say something with my, if I can actually say it without losing my voice.
Okay, go ahead.
This is the end of year one for us, right?
That's right.
This is the last episode of 2018.
That's why I'm losing my voice. I can't take it anymore.
Right. This is the first year of Writer's Blockbuster.
So I just wanted to say thank you to you guys, but also to the listeners.
For anyone that's been with us.
There's like
both
100
of them?
Yeah, two. There's like two people out there, man, every week. No, there's like 150 listeners every week, and that's really cool.
Yeah, so, every 2 weeks.
Every
but
two
yes,
weeks, yeah.
But thank you, seriously.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Thank you for doing a podcast with me for both of you.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
This has been
awesome.
So, yeah.
Good fun. We'll have to see where we take it
once Jamie's double feature airs on Christmas, though.
He won't be leaving.
I don't know.
This double feature has been airing for a couple years.
Yeah.
It hasn't quite taken me to the heights of Home Alone in Space.
Jamie, what time is it playing?
All day. I don't know off the top of my head. But okay. And it's also playing all weekend, this weekend.
So if you listen to Writer's Blockbusters and you've listened to the genius that is Jamie Nash discuss these movies, you can watch his movies.
Watch me rip off Home Alone right and left.
And then you can, if you want, you can tweet him and tell him, like, well, your movie sucks.
where's the blind obsession there, dude?
Yeah, I don't see anything. This is a fun and games.
Yeah, one montage for the fun and games.
There's no 5-point finale.
You didn't direct them or anything, though. You're just writing. Right?
Savage Steve Holland is to blame.
That's so awesome, though,
man. Yeah, that's so awesome.
Yeah, he did St. Honors.
That's the guy, if you don't know listening, that's the guy who directed Better Off Dead and One Crazy Summer.
So awesome.
By the way, this is a total aside, but who the hell cares? It's Christmas.
It's Christmas.
That Kurt Russell movie that came out.
Christmas Chronicles.
I didn't see it.
So essentially when I sold Santa Hunters, that sold at the exact same time, and our scripts were almost identical. Now, mine went the Nickelodeon route, and theirs went a different, like, lower budget route.
Okay.
But both of ours were kind of Christopher Columbus. I keep going Christopher. The guy, Chris Columbus, found footage type movies. And both were had almost the same plots. To the point when I saw theirs come out, it was called 1224 at the time. I was like, oh no, this isn't good. You know, if theirs gets made before mine, mine will be sunk. But Nickelodeon can make them in a year, and it takes a long time to go through the development process. I think they both sold around 2012 or 2013.
So it took 6 years for the other one to...
The other one was a blacklist script. Yeah.
Christmas Chronicles.
Wow.
Christmas Chronicles. 1224 it was called.
The end product, I don't know if you guys watched it, but the end product is not a found footage movie, really.
No.
It could be.
Nor was,
it could have turned
nor was
into
Santa
that.
Hunters. It hinted at it, and it could have been, but they decided not to do it at that time.
Okay.
So both of them started as found footage. Both of them became pieces with found footage, but
okay.
Not.
There's a camera element in Christmas Chronicles that could totally make it
same
found
with
footage.
Santa Hunters. And again, Santa Hunters is the Nickelodeon, and I think 1224, which became Christmas Chronicles, is more like the kind of, I don't know, broader movie. What's the word? Four quadrant movie.
Okay.
You know? Whereas one is, the ones I write are really for the little kids, and that one they kept at least for their parents to be able to get through it and enjoy it. And they put Kurt Russell in, which makes a lot of adults want to watch it.
I mean, that's he's become like a meme and stuff now, so.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So get Kurt Russell next time, Jamie.
Jesus.
Come
Jamie.
On. What are you thinking?
Exactly.
Just kidding. Watch Jamie's double feature on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
The listings are Googleable, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Right.
I always Google them every year to count for residual purposes. Like, how many times is it on?
Right. And thanks for listening.
Yeah,
for
thanks for listening.
Thanks
so appreciate much. It.
Yeah. All
happy
right.
Holidays.
We're going to say bye so we're not meandering forever.
Bye.
Bye.
You've just listened to Writer's Blockbusters, a screenwriting podcast featuring two professionals and another guy. Available only on Thundergrunt.